You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Both on the elections panel that was originally scheduled from 2 until 3:30, and also for Josie Celestine from Copa Viva, Haitian organization working on issues of sexual violence in the camps, who had planned to travel here today, but because of the situation in Port-au-Prince has been unable to do so. In any event, we're glad that we're able to continue. We have three speakers who will be talking to us about different aspects of protection of women and the general situation, at least in terms of a humanitarian perspective in Haiti right now. Like many of you, we've been following very closely what's been happening in Haiti, asking questions of, it's been 11 months. Why are women still being raped? Why are people still living under tents and plastic sheeting after so long? And yet, as I reminded my colleagues, I read this week and or finished the book called The Great Deluge about Hurricane Katrina and the 5 days that occurred 5 years ago in that city, a city where the U.S. government certainly had many more resources than were available to the Haitian government, where you saw a similar breakdown of law and order and humanitarian challenges galore. We have three speakers. We'll begin with Sarah Williamson from the U.S. Committee on Refugees and Immigrants, who's been working with USCRI for some years, opened the office in Haiti, has a lot of humanitarian experience in different settings. She'll be followed by Vincent Cochetel, the representative of the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees here in Washington, who I think has worked for over 20 years in humanitarian affairs. And actually, the idea for this panel came from a discussion we had back in October when he said to me something like, just got back from Haiti, I've been working in humanitarian issues for more than 25 years, and yet the situation for women is as bad as I've ever seen it. Finally, we'll hear from Holly Mackey from the Special Coordinators Unit on Haiti at the U.S. Department of State, who will be talking about some of the actions the U.S. government is taking to address the issue of violence against women and other protection issues. So we'll start with you, Sarah. Welcome.
Thank you, Beth. I want to thank Brookings for having this important forum, and I'm sure many of you who have been working on Haiti a lot this year are aware that the upcoming anniversary of the earthquake is going to be a sober time as we reflect on what has taken place over the course of the past 11 months. And so this is a good opportunity to think about perspectives moving forward. So thank you, Beth, for hosting us here today. The U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants is working in partnership with a local NGO in Port-au-Prince, and that NGO is called GAR, the Groupe d'Appui aux Rapatriés et Réfugiés, the Support Group for Returnees and Refugees. And GAR has a national network that assists Haitians who are repatriated both from the Dominican Republic and from the United States. And we began assisting GAR immediately after the earthquake when we got in touch with their leadership in Port-au-Prince, and we discovered that their building had sustained considerable damage and that the majority of their staff were homeless on the streets and unable to access the mass distributions. And so I went down into Santo Domingo and procured supplies and did a targeted distribution specifically for them as a sister organization and assisted them in building their capacity to operate. GAR normally focuses on the border and on port areas of Haiti, but in this instance, due to the unusual mass displacement in the capital, they really needed to have protection teams that could operate in an urban environment, which was relatively new for them. And one of our first objectives was to connect GAR and other local Haitian groups to the UN system, which many of you know has established its humanitarian response system through the cluster system, which groups agencies together into various sectors. And we are most involved in the protection cluster, which is led by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and in part by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees as well. And I want to share with you a little bit about our program of protection monitoring and how we see the situation not only in the camps, but also in host communities. But I really want to spend some time addressing some of the myths that I think are becoming commonly shared among humanitarian actors in Haiti, and try to debunk some of those myths with what I see as the realities on the ground, and then moving forward, what kind of solutions are available to those who are displaced so that they can move on to a more dignified life in a better area. Our work is really focused on the protection of people both in the camps in Port-au-Prince and in host communities. And this means looking at risks, looking at vulnerabilities, looking at the factors that make someone particularly vulnerable, and trying to provide vulnerable people with targeted assistance, such as transportation, food, medicine, housing, and support for other fees, such as school fees or medical bills. And this is a little different because in a camp environment, you have many people, but certainly those who are handicapped, elderly persons, women who are newly widowed with numerous children find themselves in a particularly precarious situation and need more targeted help. And we also have put a lot of emphasis in the communities where we work on helping displaced people present themselves and their problems directly to local and national authorities so that they can begin to negotiate some assistance from those who, according to international guidelines and standards, are responsible for making decisions to assist them in finding better places to live. So that's a little bit about what we do. But I think what's really important is to talk about some of the myths and realities that we see now over the course of time. And when I say myths, oftentimes in humanitarian emergencies, we blame the media for getting the facts wrong. But oftentimes I see now, even in the donor community and among humanitarian agencies, that the situation is so overwhelming that we've started to believe certain things that aren't true about the situation. And the first myth is that Haitian organizations are not capable of working with the international system. This is certainly not true. Haiti has a large number of local organizations and community-based groups that are fully capable of establishing partnership with international organizations and donors. They're just particularly underutilized in this instance. A second myth is that initial emergency assistance covered the need, that blanket coverage of assistance was achieved in the first 3 months of the emergency. I don't believe this to be the case, particularly when you go into a camp or host community and you dissect the needs of the population. You can even meet people who still have not received medical treatment or who haven't located relatives who've been missing since the quake. These kinds of things just are too frequent to say that the community achieved blanket coverage. A third myth is that those who are vulnerable now were always vulnerable and that there are no longer earthquake-affected people who need assistance in Haiti. This is simply also not true. There are many vulnerable people who are predominantly affected by the earthquake. They may have always lived in poor conditions or in poverty. But many of the most vulnerable people that we meet have lost all their support mechanisms, and this has happened predominantly through death of primary relatives and other support systems that they would have relied on, other friends and family members who had earned an income and helped provide for their general support. Another myth is that there is a functioning government in Haiti that can be held accountable for decision-making, and I think you do start to see this myth debunked in recent events with the results of the election and the ongoing fighting about this, but it was very frustrating at the onset of the emergency to be in countless meetings with the heads of donor agencies, UN agencies and with local government officials and see this emphasis on national authorities and their responsibility to make decisions that never came. And so I think that for the international community that needs to say there is a functioning state that is predominantly responsible, that I don't feel that this is a case in Haiti and hasn't been the case well before the election. And then the last myth I want to talk about, which leads to the topic of solutions, is there's a myth that engineering surveys of household destruction tell us what durable solutions are available to people. And again, those of you who've been closely involved with the emergency know that the U.S. military has, in the early days, assisted in determining which of the sites were most at risk and most vulnerable camps, and also many engineers were trained, local engineers, to mark houses as red, meaning that they needed to be destroyed and they were uninhabitable. Yellow, meaning that they needed repair and then could be utilized. Or green, meaning that people were ready to move into them. All kinds of surveys and information tools have been used and developed by humanitarian emergency actors as a result of these initial surveys saying who will go home, who won't go home, and who will move on elsewhere. But I believe the data is inadequate to actually show us what people will do. So I want to tell you about some realities that we've seen in the field that have made these myths come to light. You know, in the early days of the emergency, when a coordination support committee was established between donors, the state, and UN agencies and humanitarian actors, at the end of these meetings, there would always be results that had been decided by the government. But in effect, all of the plans and strategies were drafted by international agencies and international actors. And therefore, the international community has a special responsibility for some of the decisions that were taken in that time frame. In terms of vulnerability, we see particularly women who are forced to engage in very negative coping mechanisms in order to receive assistance. So we see women who were previously married and had numerous children who lost their spouses start to take multiple partners who will give them various kinds of food items in exchange for their friendship. We see women getting pregnant so that they can be eligible for World Food Program food assistance. In one community, we even see men infecting themselves with HIV/AIDS so that they can get medical treatment at local health clinics, which also give benefit packages to those who are HIV positive. And we see older people who no longer have any other surviving relatives committing suicide. And so these kinds of protection problems show that the widespread reports of humanitarian assistance to those who are affected having been achieved is not really addressing these protection realities. I also want to share the reality that local organizations are much better at knowing what's going on in a community than many of the international actors who are engaging in operations. They know better because of language. They can discern the truth beyond the stereotypes, as many of you who've engaged in relief know that beneficiaries become very good at telling all kinds of stories that will get them more assistance. And oftentimes, local actors can tell the difference between perceived need, real need, and something that's simply not true. And local actors can also break down distributions into smaller packages so that it's virtually impossible to see what is being given to who. And this is very important in the current security context in which large convoys and mass supplies can't get through riots and crowds and other public disturbances. Local actors and some people on our team will carry supplies in something as small as a backpack that will assist a widow or an elderly person for up to a month. So these kinds of things local actors are much better at than we are. And another thing that happened for at-risk sites is that new locations were established for relocating people who were thought to be at risk of landslides and all the rains and hurricanes. And so many of these people were brought to Tabar Isa or Karai. And relocation to a new settlement is really not a durable solution without telling people whether they have a right to use the land or residency. One of the most pressing needs that we see now is the effort to get people out of this camp environment and transition into a new place where they can become more stable. Many of the people who are displaced do not have land or houses to return to. And those people who are particularly unemployed or without a means to earn a livelihood are not able to pay the rent to find another place, and they're particularly disadvantaged. This is a big problem. There are also push and pull factors in terms of where people go from here. People movement in large-scale emergencies is often based on changing conditions and not on fixed data like the surveys I mentioned that the engineers have done. Many people have started leaving the camps out of fear that they would catch cholera out of the hurricanes and storms, and some data now shows that nearly 500,000 people have left camps. However, new data also shows that certain camps have enlarged and that families are separating and leaving an anchor relative in one of the larger camps that is still receiving assistance just in case free stuff is given out that they can bring back to their hometown. So some of these factors are a bit disturbing when it comes to how do we achieve solutions from here. But I would say the most important thing to remember is that people need to be given a choice and that the international community needs to ask those who are displaced what their intentions are for their future and try to work together with local communities to address the barriers that keep them from moving on and develop programs that are specifically focused around the transition to life outside of the camp context. This is something that USCRI is committed to doing with all of our programs in 2011. We'll be based on helping households leave camps so that they can be in a more normalized environment. And I would say that this is critical to making the transition from the relief effort to the development effort, and that there really can't be development in Haiti when you have the population in this kind of flux, which means that donors also will need to focus their attention on having a strategy to address this mass displacement problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Melissa?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, and thank you very much to Brookings for the invitation to share some concerns, some observation about the situation in Haiti. And thank you, Sarah. You've helped me reducing a bit what I wanted to say today. And I won't talk about the election, and I won't talk about the cholera. The cholera is certainly bad news for the Haitian people. Unfortunately, the progression of cholera in that sort of situation is likely to lead to more people affected by the cholera in the next 6 months. There's little that can be done about it. I think the international community is now mobilizing efforts to fight the cholera. Number of deaths hopefully will stabilize, but it has to be worse before it gets better, unfortunately. And that's bad news in many respects. Bad news because it's distracting donor attention. It's bad news because it shadows all the other problems that are, as a result, not addressed. Funding is limited. Cholera is a priority. I'm not questioning that. But at the time that we're fighting cholera, the other issues are not addressed. So we'll be talking about the other issues. I'm not a specialist of Haiti. I'm covering Haiti out of Washington for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees Office here. I've been a couple of times in Haiti. We have a small team there doing some very limited operational activities there. But what I do every time I go to Haiti, I spend a lot of time talking to people. I go to the camps, and I sit, and I observe, and I read. And I wish sometime my colleagues in the UN team would spend more time with the people, because what you hear makes sense, and people have solutions. People are not without intellectual resources to find some of those solutions. But rather than exposing the complexity of the humanitarian problem as they stand today, 11 months after the earthquake, I decided I'll just pick up some of the news items over the last couple of days and share with you my observation on how they relate to those protection concerns and humanitarian concerns. And you may ask, are there some good news coming from Haiti? Yes and no. There are some good news, as I said, on the mobilization against cholera. I think efforts have been made. There are also some good news that came on the 9th of December when IOM reported that the number of IDPs had decreased by 31%. So bringing the number of people in IDP camps to something like 1 million people, and that the number of IDP sites has decreased from 1,356 to 1,199. Now, when you look at the report and the analysis of the report, because that's estimated, it's not a household-by-household registration, when you look at the rationale for the estimated decrease of the IDP population, four are stated in the report. Some of the camps were dismantled because of their vulnerability. You know, some of the tents that were set up in January are not making it through the year. I mean, today it's very cold in Haiti. There's torrential rain there. And I don't know if you have been to Haiti. When it rains, it rains. And those tents, I mean, they are not able to hold the weight of the water for long. They collapse. Some of the tents that had been distributed there were not meant to last more than a couple of months, but certainly not for a year. So some of the camps have disappeared because of the rain. Second cause of the decrease, there has been some return incentive provided to people, and some resettlement schemes have been put in place. Well, resettlement schemes, we have not seen any relocation of any type over the last couple of months in Haiti. That has not happened. But incentive to leave camps, we've seen that. You have people coming with money. Sometimes we're not able to identify who are those individuals, probably middlemen acting on behalf of some of the landowners where the IDP camps are located. Those people give $100, $150 to each family to move on. So the IDP camp disappears. So the number reduces. Third consideration of IOM, there's been a decrease of services in camp, and those services are available elsewhere. I think it's certainly true in the area of health services. I think most of the actors involved in the health services have made an effort to try to connect to public institutions and provide services in the neighborhoods rather than in the camps. I think that's a welcome development. At the same time, I've not seen much decreases of services in the camps. There is very little happening in the camps except provision of water, a bit of sanitary material since the breakout of the cholera, but otherwise most of the basic services have disappeared a couple of months ago. The fourth reason for the decrease of the number of IDP camps on the number of IDPs in camps in general is an increased level of eviction. So people are forcibly evicted. The lucky one gets a bit of pocket money to move on. The others are evicted through the use of violence or threats of violence. As we speak today, there are 56 camps that are where we face this problem of eviction. So we try to set up a dialogue with landowners when we are able to identify them, but in many instances we don't find them, and you have gangs that are paid to push the people away. So people move because it's no longer a camp, it's not an IDP camp, they are off the statistics. Question is where those people move. Assuming they move back to their place of former residence would need to be seriously verified. I have strong doubts about it. When I go to Port-au-Prince and around Port-au-Prince, I see settlements, spontaneous settlements, mushrooming everywhere. These are not IDP camps. The government of Haiti said, don't touch that. Don't touch those settlements. So we don't want to call them camps. So they're no longer on the radar screen of the humanitarian actors. They are off limits. We take them off the statistics. Well, if we want the IDPs to become invisible, let's continue like that. They'll be invisible. We will have slum tents, sites all over Haiti. We won't have camps anymore. That's one way to look at it. But what will be the cost of ignoring the situation in those spontaneous settlements remains to be seen. That was my news, reading of the news on the night of December. On the 10th of December, there was the anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What happened that day on Haiti? First, we got in the morning news that a young journalist, quite courageous, writing in the Haiti Press Network, had been stabbed in Santo. He's still between life and death in an hospital. At the same time, a rap singer was stoned almost to death in Saint-Marc. So these were two targeted, politically targeted incidents on that day of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Let's not forget, when the earthquake struck in Haiti, in front of the presidential palace, you had a demonstration of about 3,000 people protesting the assassination of a professor at university. So earthquake was there. Cholera was there, Hurricane Thomas came, political assassinations, human rights violations continue in Haiti every day. This morning it's 23 people killed by machete, accused of having spread the virus of cholera in one of the communes. Every day you get those news if we want to read those news. So we have a situation that is very problematic in terms of human rights violation, and that's not only affecting IDPs, it's affecting other people who try to bring some changes to the situation. What happened on the 10th of December also, another news item that caught my attention, was 127 Haitians were rescued on return by a U.S. Coast Guard cutter, and they were rescued and sent to Port Haitien. Nobody knows who were those people, what were their needs, where they came from. You have not read this news in your newspaper. You have not heard from my mouth the word interception, but at some stage we will have to look into those policies. The same time that this happened, another boat capsized. Some people died near the Bermuda Virgin Islands. Some of the Haitians were rescued. Some of them have been returned. We were not able to prevent their return to the Haitians. And when we talked to the authorities, they told us, you know, we do like the U.S. does. So how do you want us to convince Bahamas? How do you want us to convince Jamaica? How do you want us to convince Turks and Caicos that, you know, we should look into the individual needs of those people? Are they migrants? Do they have protection problems if others behave a different way? There is not a unique solution. We need differentiated approaches for migrants, for people who may have some protection needs, but we will have to go back to discussion on those issues. I won't talk about 11-12 December. We have lots of news from Haiti, but they were all around the election, very interesting blogs, all sorts of things on these elections, on what went wrong, and what could have been prevented, what was predictable in terms of what went wrong. Then Monday 13, we got from the Secretariat of the Interim Haiti Reconstruction Commission, that's the body that oversees the major reconstruction effort in the country, we've got a beautiful document, which is called the Strategic Plan for the Remainder of the IHRC mandate. We had 1 hour to provide comments on that document. That's a third document coming from the Interim IT Reconstruction Commission. It's interesting, the title says the remainder of the mandate of that commission. Well, it's not sure it will survive the new government when we have a new government. But anyway, look through the document very quickly, provided some comments, not very high quality comments. We had 1 hour. And I'll just go over three issues. One is housing. Sarah touched about that. Document talks about registering everybody to find out complete registration of all earthquake-affected households and identify a housing solution for each. So we all applaud to that. The problem is that nobody is planning for that registration. You have UN Habitat with the Ministry of Reconstruction that has been proposing what is called participatory enumeration at the neighborhood level to find out who was living there, but with no real outreach communication with the people in the camp, so nobody knows how it's going to work. IOM has no plan to re-register people in the camp. It's more profiling activities to consolidate existing data. So it's not really clear how the Interim Commission approach this exercise. But what one interesting comment in one of the table, it is said that the people have moved and stayed in the camps in order to be eligible for expected assistance. And there, that worries me. If this is what the Interim IT Reconstruction think, we're going to have a lot of work to do to make them understand who are the people in the camps. I'm not disclaiming that some of the people in the camps maybe should not be in the camps. I met some people said, we still have a house or a place to go in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince. We don't want to go there because we're scared. We go during the day, but we sleep in the camp at night. They are traumatized people. A bit of counseling, a bit of assistance, they'll be able to make it back. But the vast majority of people, they have nowhere to go. When Hurricane Thomas came, we tried to evacuate with some other agencies, people to some churches, to the grounds of some of the schools. People refused to go. And people refused to go because they were scared that they would not be able to go back to their camp after. That the landowner would repossess the land and would not be able to make it back. So if people had other alternative to go somewhere else with relatives in the country or go back to a place where they could safely live, I mean, people would have done it over the last 10, 11 months. But if the Interim Commission believed that people stayed in camps in order to be eligible for expected assistance, I think there is a need for dialogue on those issues. Land ownership. Again, that document from the Interim Commission says the government should abandon appropriation processes for land declared of public utility. Nice jargon. What does that mean? It means the government should stop using one of the articles in their law that dates back to the beginning of the 20th century that enables the government in exceptional circumstances to nationalize the land. We have a problem. In order to bring solutions to people, we will need more land. We need access to land. There's plenty of empty lands in Haiti, but it belongs to individuals. It does not belong to the state. It does not belong to the commune. So if the government does not want to use its legislation to declare some land of public use and public interest and compensate the landowner for the purchase of the land, then there is no solution of relocation. People are going to stay where they are. And I'm very concerned to see that in the strategic plan of the Interim Commission. Third point, education. The strategy of the Interim Commission is the same that the strategy of the Haitian government that was explained at the March Donors Conference in New York, promotion of education for all, so there is consistency with the Millennium Development Goal. Again, we all applaud to that. But what is foreseen in terms of activity? Provision of financial assistance, $125 to 500,000 children, so they can get access to private school. What happened after 1 year? Will those schools keep those kids? The whole purpose of some of this strategic thinking was to build back better, not to build back the same. If the reconstruction effort is to support a private school system that has not been including or inclusive of for the poor Haitian kids, then we're not going to promote access to affordable education for kids. And there is a total disconnect again with stated objective on what's happening at the activity level. I find that very problematic. Last piece of news yesterday was this report from another organization like COFAVIV, like KEFAN, another Haitian organization, SOFA, Solidarité Femme Haïtienne, who reported on their activities regarding with victims of sexual gender-based violence. They do a bit of trauma relief activities, and they also have a legal assistance project. They've been assisting 718 cases in 5 districts between January and June 2010. Their report is only coming out now. Less than 1% of the perpetrator of those acts of sexual violence have been arrested. A high proportion of the victims are girls, below 16. And most of them, more than 50% of them, have not only been subject to rape or other sexual assault, but also to act of torture like immolation, burning, or something that we've seen with some of those victims. They rape and they cut the tongue after. Now, there is no way we can, at this stage, bring effective protection to some of these women. Some of them, where we should make a better effort through, you know, safe houses, get them out of the camp with their relative, plug into that some livelihood activities so the people get back on their feet and assist them if they want to start proceedings against the perpetrators when they have been identified. But some of those people are terrorized. They don't want to stay in the country. They don't want to stay in the camp. And I'm not sure what we're going to do with that, but we are engaging a discussion with some of the partners here in the U.S., but also in Canada and in some other countries to see whether there could be some sort of protected entry channel for some of those victims, not a large number, but some of them, because we are not able to protect them in Haiti. Solutions on some of those humanitarian challenges in the country. I think one message is the relief efforts are not over. For many of the IDPs, those relief efforts have not started. You go to some of the camps along the Dominican Republic border. They are inside Haiti. There's no more NGOs. There's no international assistance there. There's nothing happening. Nothing. There is no camp management. There is no humanitarian organization except one in Fonds Parisien. But the 3 other camps that I'm familiar with along the border, there is no one there. So Sarah was pointing to the fact that there are some people even in need of food assistance, and it's not very popular in some circles to start about, you know, resuming some targeted food assistance, not necessarily food, but food coupon, where people could buy food from local food suppliers or local grocery to encourage the Haitian economy. I'm not talking about blanket food distribution, but there are some people that are in need of this food assistance. All the nutritional survey will tell you number one is starving. This is true, people are not starving. The question is how they survive. How many girls, 14 years old, you see with lipstick in the camp, and you know what they are doing in the night? We can choose to ignore the situation. That's one way to go about it. They're not starving. And I've heard many times in Haiti, but, you know, those problems existed back in the neighborhood before the earthquake. And this is true. Survival sex has been something happening in Haiti for many, many years in poor areas. But we're talking here about building back better. So if we're talking about building back better, it's time to look into those issues and have the sort of community mobilization with the right actors that is needed to offer alternative solution to these girls and women. Walter Kalin, the representative of the Secretary General for IDP, came for a second time to Haiti in October. In his report, he talks about differentiating displacement on general humanitarian needs. And I think he's right there. So many of these humanitarian needs, they were there before the earthquake. They're still there today, amplified in some areas. But at the same time, there are some specific needs that are related to displacement that need to be addressed. And I think what he has proposed still is still valid. I think we need to be realistic about returns. You know, Sarah said there was this beautiful engineering survey about red houses, yellow houses, red houses. Well, those who had green houses, people return there. They are there, you know. Those who could afford returning there, they return there. Those with yellow houses, damaged houses, but could be repaired, people have moved back already. They've not waited for any of us. They've not waited for any strategic plan. People move back. The question is, some of the people could not move back to those houses because they can't afford the rent. It's three times what it was before the earthquake, three times. So for a two-room, let's say, flat, it's now $120 approximately. It used to be $40 for someone. People just can't afford it. So unless we have a strong government intervention saying we return to the rental price of pre-earthquake level, people are not going to make it back. In any case, given the number of houses destroyed, you know, we should be reasonable about expectation in returns. It's going to happen, but for very few people. Majority of them have no return solution. So what are the solutions? Well, the solutions are going to be with relocation. But as I explained it before, to relocate, you need space, you need land. So you need political buying and push for that. One word of warning, I think there is no quick fix. I think we all understood it, there is no quick fix. But, you know, I see sometimes donors trying to provide assistance in a way that stabilized the situation. For instance, there was lots of money spent on cash for work. I'm not opposed philosophically to cash for work program, you know, that helps people gaining a bit, earning a bit their money, feeling useful for their community and all that. But it doesn't solve the situation. People are so much in debt. You know, the earthquake took place in January. They had to pay upfront 6 months of rent. They lost that. They're so much in debt over the last couple of months. So the little money they get from cash for work, and the most vulnerable don't get cash for work. It's out. I mean, I've talked to many women with their kids. Where do they leave their kids to go on work? I mean, it's a non-starter for many of these people. So cash for work is not bad as a stabilization measure, but it does not bring early recovery for the people, for a majority of them. I certainly would prefer more an approach based on microcredit, on provision of assistance through microcredit in the neighborhood. Sarah talked about the problem of partnering with Haitian NGOs. The UN or international actors in general, international NGOs too, have not been very good at partnering with Haitian NGOs. There are some good examples of cooperation here and there, but in general there is a bit of mistrust. I'm working for UN agency, so as I'm working for UN agency, we are seen as part of MINUSTAH, the stabilization force, so we are the occupier. That's the way we call now. Done with the occupation by the UN forces. Oh, many NGOs see us like that. They don't want to see what we can bring in terms of know-how to help them to get back on their feet. At the same time, we have to have a more inclusive approach with the Haitian NGOs. And regardless whether they are politically motivated, many of them have a political orientation. They were there before the earthquake. They have the experience. They have the connection. And we have to work through them. There is no other way around. But there is a bit of restoration of a more healthy dialogue between NGOs and international actors that need to take place. And the last thing, I think, and I'll conclude with that, I think for the donors, when we have an Haitian government, we should not wait and see. Right from the start, with whatever government will come out from this political mess, we will have to demand to the government a certain number of things. One is clear commitment on free access to education, clear commitment on returning to affordable rental price, clear commitment to repossess some of the land or buy some of the land that is needed for relocation, and acknowledging that the problem of IDP is not going to disappear in one day. I've seen 3-4 plans over the last 3 months written by different international consultants on how to sort out the problem of IT. They all think about, 75,000 people can find solution every month. No, it's not happening like that. It's going to take more time. Even if we were going to close one IDP camp per day, it would take 3 years of continuous effort to have no more IDP camps in IT. So let's not dream. There's no quick fix. It's going to take time, and it requires sustained commitment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vincent. We'll turn now to Holly Mackey from the State Department.
I'd just like to start by thanking both Vincent and Sarah for their remarks. I think they have made many of the points that I was actually going to make, so that makes my job easier. I want to focus today a little bit more on the problem of sexual and gender-based violence, on protection in general, but specifically on the problem of SGBV, which I'm sure you have all heard is a very serious problem, particularly in the camps and in the surrounding communities. And Vincent gave you some sort of anecdotal evidence of the kinds of things that we're looking at with respect to that. I should tell you that protection of human rights and vulnerable populations is a top priority for U.S. government assistance to Haiti. It is written in the draft USG strategy, and it is something that officials in the U.S. government at the highest levels have communicated as something that we need to be focusing on, not just in the near term, but in the long term, as Vincent pointed out. To that end, I want to talk today about focusing not only on meeting immediate needs of vulnerable communities through protection and response, but at the same time focus on making sure that we all realize that it's essential to work toward building sustainable solutions for countering these problems in the long term. And we can't start with one and then move to the other. We have to be thinking about both protection and response and long-term empowerment at the same time going forward. So as we, the U.S. government, and we, the international community, craft our plans for addressing protection, gender-based violence, we need to take this sort of multifaceted approach. And I just want to talk about sort of five different areas along that continuum that I think we can address. Some of this we're already doing. Much of it we're not, and we need to be thinking about going forward. So the first is immediately improving security to deter attacks and to respond quickly and effectively when we hear about reports of attacks. This is something that MINUSTA is engaged in. This is something that the Haitian National Police are engaged in. And we need to make sure that we're bolstering both the capacity of MINUSTA and the HNP to do this. Secondly, we need to work to better provide victim services to mitigate the lasting, what we know are lasting physical and psychological injuries that are often associated with these kinds of crimes. Third, and importantly, we need to get a better understanding of the scope of the problem in order to divide targeted and appropriate responses. Fourth, and this is more toward the durable solutions end, we need to build institutional capacity in Haiti to address this problem, not only in the government, whatever government emerges from this process, but also throughout civil society in Haiti. And finally, we need to think about empowerment. We need to think about empowering vulnerable populations, specifically women and girls. So I'll just move on and touch specifically on each of these areas really quickly. In terms of improving security, there are many things that we're doing, and I'll just give you a few examples. You know, we're working on lighting and layout issues in some of the IDP camps. We've purchased lots of flashlights and headlamps to facilitate nighttime patrols by security forces. We've installed security kiosks in many of the camps so that we can have a 24-hour security presence in the camps. And, you know, we're working to recruit female police officers as well as officers with special victims unit backgrounds to serve in UNPOL to sort of boost the capacity there. And we're working simply to build a more robust Haitian National Police because we know that SGBV is not a problem just in the camps, but it's a problem throughout Haiti. That said, while these things are necessary, they are in no way sufficient, and we recognize that as well. As you've undoubtedly heard, there are numerous stories of victims, particularly in the camps, who approach a police officer, tell them about the crime, and are either brushed off, not taken seriously, or just sort of treated as a very low priority. Clearly, we need to focus on officer training and sensitization. We need to recruit and assign female police officers, and we, as an international community, need to push for security sector leadership to treat sexual and gender-based violence as a priority, because if it is not treated as a priority at the top, it will not be treated as a priority at the action level. Secondly, to speak to victim services, over the last year, USAID programs have assisted various NGOs and the government of Haiti to increase the quality and the scope of services available to victims of violence. We're talking about assistance to organizations that provide psychosocial, medical referrals, care and treatment. We're talking about assistance to hospitals that have established specialized medical units to attend to victims of SGBV. And we're talking about support to NGOs to provide shelter services and legal assistance. But as with respect to security, there's so much more to be done. Most importantly, we need to think about this legal assistance part. Victims are rarely successful at finding redress, and I believe that Vincent touched on that. Successful prosecution is key to illustrating that these types of crimes are taken seriously and will not be tolerated. And when you do not have successful prosecutions, that sends the message that, well, this is just okay, so we'll continue to do it. This sort of lack of legal redress is really symptomatic of extreme weakness across the board in the Haitian judicial system and along the penal chain. This is not something that is just with respect to this particular issue. This is a much broader challenge, and maybe the topic of another panel. But that's also something that the U.S. government is trying to wrap our heads around. We need to continue to support community-based response initiatives. Just like Vincent said, these efforts are more effective because they're locally grown. And we need to address, particularly with respect to SGBV, what is probably significant underreporting due to several factors, one of which is the clear social stigma attached to being a victim. I want to talk quickly also about understanding the problem. We do have a lack of hard data and analytical capability in Haiti needed to sort of understand where these crimes are occurring and to what degree, when, so that we as responders or as the international community providing assistance to responders can help devise the best strategies. There are a lot of folks out there who say, you know what, that's not true. There's lots of data, and there is a lot of data, but it's not compiled in a comprehensive way, and that's something that we need to be thinking about. Now, there are several organizations that are working to do that. I think UNIFEM is one of them. We need to continue to support these efforts and ensure that they're coordinated and complementary. We have to work with law enforcement to institute or improve data collection in the Haitian communities. I recently spent some time at the commissariat, just sort of across the street from Cité Soleil. And they are only now just there in Cité Soleil with lots and lots of effort starting to compile data with respect to these kinds of crimes. So we want to continue that going forward. As I've alluded to, it's going to be impossible to create sustainable solutions without building the capacity of key Haitian institutions. Haitian National Police is obviously one. We're talking specifically about an emphasis on assistance to the Brigade for Protection of Minors, which is a subset that we need to target, and we need to help the HMP target recruitment of female officers. Judicial strengthening, key, I already talked about that. On the governance and administrative side, we need to continue to support the Ministry of Women's Affairs, the Office of Citizen Protection, and the Office of the National Ombudsman, because we need to try to facilitate a national-level engagement on these topics. Finally, again, we need to support local civil society organizations like COFAFIV and some of these others that Marcel mentioned, because they're essential for mobilizing community support and action and creating locally owned and relevant responses. Sarah talked to that as well. You absolutely have to work through indigenous organizations in order to accomplish many of the goals that we're talking about today. Finally, I want to talk just a little bit about empowerment. I'm constantly asking the folks, we have a women's issues office in the State Department, and I'm constantly saying, well, what does this mean? You know, you tell me let's empower women to be agents of change. I'm like, I don't really know what that means. Tell me what that means. And they tell me that this women's empowerment has five components. One is a woman's sense of self-worth. Two is their right to have and determine their own choices. Three, their right to have access to opportunities and resources. Four, their right to have power to control their own lives, both within and outside of their home. And five, their ability to influence the direction of social change to create a more just social and economic order. Now, this is all according to UNFPA, and it covers a lot, and these are lofty goals. I think in the Haitian context, there are a number of things that we can do to sort of move toward this goal. Some of these include supporting key legislation against trafficking and domestic violence, which does not exist currently. The good news is that it is in the draft penal code that is still in draft form and has yet to be passed, but those things are addressed in the draft penal code. Another thing that we need to do, and both Vincent and Sarah talked about it, is work to improve the overall economic position of women in Haiti and other vulnerable populations. Among women, there's 33% higher unemployment in the formal sector, and when employed, they earn two and a half times less on average. We also need to address gender imbalances related to access of key services and opportunities, like Vincent spoke to, education, health, political participation. And finally, we need to raise awareness of GBV's destructive effects through community-based messaging, also through messaging at the national level, and with targeted campaigns for men and boys. It's very important. So before I close, I just want to sort of wrap it up and say, there are obviously a number of challenges we have to addressing protection and empowerment in Haiti. First and foremost is the overall context. We've got over a million people living in IDP camps. Probably this is going to be a huge challenge for a long time, as Vincent also pointed out. We've got a cholera outbreak that's already affected more than 90,000 people nationwide and will continue to affect more. We have extreme political uncertainty, particularly right now, and a very tense security environment. Addressing women's empowerment and sexual and gender-based violence would be challenging in any reconstruction environment. Obviously, Haiti is no exception. Secondly, and this is something that I keep harping on, but to effectively address crime, you need a functioning justice system. That's just the way it goes. Low levels of capacity along the entirety of the penal chain in Haiti are going to impede our progress. So this is rule of law in Haiti is something we absolutely must understand is a top priority. Finally, and Vincent touched on this as well, the timeline for building sustainable solutions is a long one. In fact, we're talking generations. True empowerment is going to take many years, and we as the international community, we as the U.S. government, will have to remain engaged over that time period. Because as soon as we start to move our attention toward the next disaster or the next place, that is when, and our attention starts to wane, that's when we lose some of this momentum. On the upside, we have a number of opportunities, and I just alluded to this. I think we're at a moment in time when we have almost unprecedented attention in Haiti in terms of the media, in terms of the engagement on the part of the international community, and with specific respect to protection, the importance that most donors are placing on protection. It's a top priority for the U.S. government. I can name several other donors for whom it is also a top priority. So let's leverage that. Secondly, and this is specifically with respect to women and girls, but women make up the backbone of Haitian society and the local economy. Nearly half of all Haitian households are women-headed. Women are key players in community activities. They're the lead economic actors in the informal sector, which, of course, is huge. They are the majority of the sort of petty commerce vendors that you see on the streets. And they're the majority of the microloan recipients that Vincent was talking about. We have an opportunity to harness real power here, and we shouldn't lose that opportunity. So clearly it's not only our goals with respect specifically to protection and empowerment of women that rely on our continued engagement and our ability to sort of harness this power, but it's really our overall goals for reconstruction and for this sort of sense of building back better in general. Haiti. And with that.
Thank you very much, Holly, and thanks to all of our panelists for a somewhat depressing overview of the situation in the country. We have time now for questions, but maybe I'll start and ask a question about the comment you made about the occupying forces or where international NGOs or the UN are seeing as occupiers. Given what we know about humanitarian emergencies everywhere, the importance of working with local organizations from the beginning is stressed across the board. Why didn't that happen? What went wrong in terms of working with Haitian organizations from the beginning? Sarah?
Yeah, I can address that. I think that some of it is as simple as space, in the sense that in the aftermath of the earthquake, all the international organizations and donors really concentrated at the airport. And in order to do that, that space was really blocked off to the local population. And even if you were going to go in and out of that space, it could take you 1 to 2 hours to enter and to exit. And a lot of people were living in tents on the airfield because there was no safe shelter, even for relief workers. So getting local people into those meetings was very difficult. The first meeting that we organized between the UN clusters and the local NGOs did occur in the local community in the Delma area of Port-au-Prince. And I would have to say that it, according to some people, it was a success because we had over 40 local NGOs represented and we had all the different UN agencies represented. But in another way, it was a failure because the local people were concerned about their families. They were concerned about their communities. They were dealing with just picking themselves back up. And the UN people were saying, well, you should come to our meetings, you should come to our log base, you should come to our office, you should join us for our process, and you should fill out our papers and give data to our database. And these were people who, you know, had lost everything, and they didn't have their computers, and they didn't have their cell phones, and they didn't have their cars, and they didn't have their jobs, And here, there was just this complete disconnect between, the local people who could offer immediate on-the-ground assistance to a wide range of people and the UN and international actors who could offer the money, the technology, the meeting space, the information. Mm-hmm. But there was no bridge between the two.
Okay. Questions? We have a microphone. If you'll please identify yourself and either direct your, please, yes.
Please.
Here's your microphone, yeah.
Oh, okay. I can usually speak loud enough, but I'll use the microphone. Is that going to help? Everybody hear me? My name is Peter Appleton. I'm the director of the North Carolina Agribusiness Project in Haiti. We're actually in there in the Burrell area, which is north of St. Mark in the Arcabit Valley. And we're actually have people in there, and we're trying to produce some food. And we're obviously, I came here, I drove 5 hours with my colleague, today to some hope from you. And I'm very discouraged. In the 90s, I spent time in Rwanda during the genocide, and I heard the rumor going around that we would never let that happen again. Well, I'm sorry, we're letting it happen again. We have a small compound, we have 2,000 people living in it right now. We have a hospital in Pierre Payen. It's full, people are in the aisles. They're in the emergency ward, they're in the courtyard. We're letting it happen again. And I'm hearing, which bothers me a lot, we got to figure out what the problem is. Ladies and gentlemen, we know what the problem is. We're just trying to find reasons not to act. That bothers me a lot. And I don't know whether other people here, I came here to make friends, and I'm afraid what I'm saying is not making a friend. But to sit here quietly and hear, we need more statistics. We need to understand what the real problem is. We've known what the real problem is all along. The Artibonite River was polluted 10 years ago. May have not been cholera bacteria, but it's been polluted and children have been swimming in it, people have been drinking in it, cleaning their food in it for the last 10 to 15 years. We, the International Committee and the community, just go on and say, well, we've got to figure out what the problem is. So I asked, Lisa, you made some very good points, but you depressed me. And, you know, I don't like being depressed, but it's terrible. When can we get our act together? I'm talking about people in this room, I'm talking about myself, and start doing this right. It's a depressing situation. A year later, and Haiti isn't as bad or worse shape than it was a year ago. Please give me some hope, if you would, please. Or anybody on the panel, or anybody in the room, please give me some hope, because we're working hard. A lot of people in this room are working hard. But you can't get up every morning when you're depressed about what you're trying to achieve. Please give me some hope.
Vincent, over here.
I have to confess, I was extremely moved when I went there. I was not prepared for that. I've seen wars. I've seen a post-conflict situation in many awful places in the world. I was not prepared for that, in the sense that I thought that the international community as a whole had learned something, that we knew better how to work together. Now, it's not easy. It's not easy because it's an urban environment, and we're not used to operate in an urban environment. There were all sorts of coordination problems because the surge of solidarity and collateral emotion after the earthquake broke all sorts of people in Haiti to help with all sorts of good intention, but not necessarily strong on coordination mechanism. Now, some of those partners have left. Some of them are still there. I think there is room and space for everybody to work there. I don't believe in macro reform in the short term in Haiti. I think some people have to think about it, and I'm pleased to hear the government is focused also on some of the long-term strategy for the country. I think as humanitarian actors, let's think small. Let's think at the level of the community. Some of our projects outside of Port-au-Prince are working much better than in Port-au-Prince. And there I see reasons for hope. When we work with some of the host families that have been sheltering displaced persons for now 11 months without much support, but they are ready to continue to provide that solidarity to those who have been displaced. Sometimes they are not relatives. So you see those solidarity mechanisms are not broken down at the provincial level. I see a lot of hope in some of the plans, of the initial plans of the government, in terms of decentralization, regional economic poles, and all that. Let's hope the new government pushes hard on that, because, you know, there is a problem also in Haiti in terms of absorption capacity. I mean, Sarah was mentioning the connection with the NGO is not happening also, because, I mean, I see my colleagues also every time I said, listen, let's go there, let's have a meeting there. Yeah, but we're going to lose 4 hours in the car, you know, getting out of the base, going to most of the IDP camps, and the traffic is awful and all that, but we have to go to the people. They're not coming to us. So we have to spend more time out there.
But I believe in solutions at the regional level. In Port-au-Prince, it's going to be more challenging unless the international community and all the donors are talking the same language when it gets to housing, when it gets to relocation. I've not seen that yet.
Other words of hope?
I would just say that, when you've worked in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan and, all over Africa, Asia, tsunami, things like this, I mean, you do have to take the long view of things. And you have to realize that without the state and good governance, there are limits in what independent humanitarian action can do. And I was pleased in your earlier comments, Vincent, to hear you talk about the political violence and political targeted killings, because I think we have to step back and remember that, there's a lot of problems that go beyond what the humanitarian community can fix with our assistance. So perspective as well, the long view, yeah. As Holly said.
What you're saying, we had 9 people die in our compound today. When I go back next week, education is not going to do the job. I guess that's a concern I have, is that we in this room are satisfied to tell the Haitian people to be patient.
No.
Time is of the essence. And when I hear politicians or political bureaucrats say to me, we got to be patient, we got to give it time, and we can't do anything, I have trouble accepting that. I'm sorry. I really do. There's 9 million people in Haiti, same population as North Carolina. If we wanted to do something, we could do something.
Let's hear these two people here in front. And maybe we'll take several at a time and then give you a chance to respond. Please.
Thanks.
Stand up, Melanie.
I'm Melanie Teff from Refugees International. I want to thank you for the focus that you put on protection of the most vulnerable in your presentations today. And I was in Haiti a couple of months ago, and I found what you said extremely accurate. One question I'd like to ask is a bit about the protection cluster and the gender-based violence subcluster in Haiti and the great difficulties that they faced. Some of the issues that have been raised today, I would argue, could have been perhaps some of them averted to some extent if we'd had a stronger protection cluster arguing about, for example, when the food assistance was stopped, even to the most vulnerable groups. And so I'd like to ask, what could be done at this time? Refugees International has expressed our concern that the Office of the High Commission for Human Rights plays a very important role in Haiti, but has not had experience in operational humanitarian protection and the need for a stronger role from UNHCR in the protection cluster. We're also concerned that the gender-based violence subcluster has one person from UNFPA in charge of it. She has other duties too, and it's not humanly possible for her to be able to do more really than work with the other clusters and work with the women's ministry. Her ability to work with the local camp-based NGOs, the women's groups, is extremely limited. What can be done to bolster the work of the protection cluster and the GBV subcluster at this time? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm right behind you.
My question is related to a statement that was made about working with local NGOs, even when pre-earthquake they had a very clear political affiliation. A lot of these were some of the most well-organized, high-potential groups, but that complexity of their political orientation, what are the nuances in navigating that? If I said, okay, yes, we'll work more with them, what should I keep in mind before doing so?
Fine, thank you. And we'll take the one in the back here, Bernadette.
Hi, I'm a consultant with the American Society of International Law. First, I'd like to ask, what are our incentives for individuals going to the countryside outside the capital being considered? And another question, how is the Haitian diaspora being included in these various policy discussions about intervention in Haiti? And with regard to this gentleman's question about hope, I have a friend who's a senior economist at the World Bank, and immediately after the earthquake, they had to convene a meeting with government officials, and one of the government officials was the Minister of Finance. And the Minister of Finance appeared at the meeting after taking the body of his son out of the rubble of his home. And that man had the strength to appear at that meeting to be able to continue to work. And if that's not a sign of hope, I don't know what is. If those people in Haiti can have that strength, whether it's that man showing up to a meeting even though he hasn't buried his son and had to physically take him out of his home, or if it's women who break out into song, into hymns, we just can't afford to lose hope here. So those are my two questions, and that's my plea for people not giving up hope, because Haitians haven't given up hope.
Thank you, Marindan. So we have questions on the protection cluster, working with local NGOs, particularly the political affiliation, incentives to go to the countryside, and the role of the Haitian diaspora. Who would like to start? Vincent?
Well, just on working with NGOs that have some political orientation, I think the important thing is to encourage them to develop non-partisan approach over the sort of programs where we want them to get engaged. There are many NGOs in Haiti that have been working on sexual on gender-based violence for many years, different affiliation. Let's work with all of them. Let's not choose only one. Let's not reinforce one against the other. Let's work with all of them, but let's also assess their capacity. Their capacity is limited, so there is place for everyone to assist in the response. But I think there are ways to get them engaged. For the time being, we're a bit scared because we're not going to be able to control them. But the objective is not to control them; is to build on their experience, on their capacity. I'm not losing hope. I want to say that. I feel a bit powerless when I go there because I see the needs and I see I can't change that, and I hate to be in that situation where, you know, there's little I can bring. But there were some women telling me, you know, to get out of prostitution, what they need is $150 and buy a bit of soap, and they will cut the soap in small pieces and set up their kiosk where they sell the soap. And that's what they were doing before the earthquake, and that's what they need now. It's doable. We can help those women to get back on their feet. They may have to stay in their tent for a long period of time, but then we have to work on the shelter, allocation of shelter, also recognizing the vulnerability of the people. For the time being, the people accessing the temporary shelter that have been built, it's unclear the criteria being used. People are moving from rows, from tented camps to temporary shelter. I think there should be a way where we prioritize based on vulnerability, because some of those women or some of those vulnerable cases, they cannot work on all fronts at the same time. So we have to give them a push through prioritized access to temporary shelter. And let's not call them temporary shelter anymore. Let's be honest. Let's be honest with ourselves. Let's call them shelter because they're not going to be temporary.
Sarah, would you like to respond to the protection cluster question?
Yeah.
It's an easy non-political question for you.
That's a difficult one, but we did bring with us a paper that was done by Interaction and Refugee Council agencies that are focused on the protection needs in Haiti, and it's outside, and you can grab it on your way out, and it has many suggestions for strengthening protection coordination. And one of the recommendations in the paper is to have better mainstreaming. And as you know, the protection cluster is just one of about 12 clusters in the country, and all the different actors need to work together more closely to think about protection, to think about GBV and water and sanitation and early recovery. And when it comes to gender in particular, we do hear a lot of women complaining that they don't have sufficient access to the cash for work programs. That shouldn't just be the GBV subcluster. It should be the early recovery cluster. And also in water and sanitation, when there are facilities brought into the camps for toilets, for example, and other things, you know, making sure they're separated and that women have a safe space and girl children have a safe space and things like that. And some of these really basic things that have always been a part of good humanitarian action, you just don't see them happening in Haiti. And so a return to the basics of everyone acting together for the same purpose. I did want to just quickly say about the local NGOs and their political orientation that it is very tricky. And, you know, there are risks associated with working and acting with people who have a political agenda, and that is something that I think that every agency needs to assess on its own in terms of its standards of cooperation and partnership. But we have seen some complications of some local groups, and it's tricky. There's not one correct answer.
Why don't we take a few more questions and maybe one more around, maybe on this side of the room?
I can respond.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no problem. I would like to just respond about what incentives are there outside of Port-au-Prince. What can there be but economic incentives? And that's something that we're focusing on by addressing this this idea of sort of economic growth poles outside of Port-au-Prince. This is not the silver bullet, right? But by developing these industrial sort of industrial growth areas, we hope to create jobs outside of Port-au-Prince and have those jobs be the incentives. And also I can respond a little bit to your question about how the diaspora is included. The Haitian diaspora is obviously a great source for the U.S. government in trying to devise our strategy going forward. And my boss, Tom Adams, the special coordinator, the Haiti special coordinator at the State Department, has been engaged in numerous discussions with various diaspora groups since he came on, in trying to understand what is it that the diaspora wants to offer, what is out there, and how can we best take advantage of that. And so, you know, the large communities sort of in Miami, in Boston, in Brooklyn and in New York have all been engaging with us, in many different fora. So we will continue to do that going forward.
Thank you. Final questions, maybe these two right here.
Hi, I'm Keith Stringfellow with Smartmatic Corporation. And I've spent quite a bit of time in Haiti since January. Previously, I spent quite a bit of time in New Orleans after Katrina, and I can tell you the contrast 11 months later is extreme. And not to diminish the risk of cholera and a lot of the short-term essential medical needs, I think my observation is that there's a huge difference in the recovery because of what I'll call the governance infrastructure. And I noticed in one of the documents that there was some discussion about addressing birth certificates. Birth certificates, based upon what we've been able to determine, are issued to probably less than 40% of the inhabitants of Haiti. Now, what's a birth certificate? Why is it important? Well, it establishes a couple of things in terms of custody, not only of children, but inheritance of families, law, land ownership, et cetera, access to public education, access to health, access to legal employment, access to voter registration, all of those things. And I think that's one of the issues that has to be addressed. I'll lump it in what I'll call an overall governance issue. Our observation is that, yes, there is room for judicial and penal overhaul. It has to happen. Things as simple as fingerprint identification of criminals. The use of aliases is just rampant down there. Now, here we're focusing on protection of children and women. Sexual predators that constantly use an alias every time they are arrested, if you don't have a way to sort through that mess, you'll never get them out of the system. So it has to be addressed. So I go to a couple of simple things. Long term, in addition to the judicial and penal overhauls, we have to address the education issue. We've got all these children being sold off as restivecs. Well, you know what? That's a learned behavior. We haven't done anything to educate the populace as to what is the proper the proper way to treat their children the way they should be treating them. I guess I want to get a little wound up, so I'll just ask the questions. First, what's being done about birth certificates? And is there anything underway to identify the legitimate citizens of Haiti, legitimize their existence so that they can have be treated equally in terms of benefits and access to law?
Thank you. And this woman right here?
Hi, my name is Karen Kahn. I'm just a concerned citizen, and excuse my naivete, but I was curious if any of you are called to testify before sustainable economic government agencies, NGOs, international organization, World Bank, because it seems that the if you look at the history of Haiti, the horrible catastrophe perhaps could have been averted if there weren't so many poor people living on the side of a mountain in mud, huddled around one city in the entire country to earn a living, and that unsustainable economic development led to this catastrophe. And if you're talking about long-term solutions, there and this goes a little bit along with what Holly was saying when it comes to an economic draw to get people back out of Port-au-Prince. They weren't always there. They're there now. To me, that seems to be not just in Haiti, but with free trade catastrophes happening all over Latin America and other places in the world, that the world has to be stopped, has to stop being looked at as if it's the way for the United States and other developing countries to make a living and to push their products while pushing the people that live in these regions to huddle on these mountains that fall into the ground and leave all these displaced persons. So I was wondering if, in the long term, you are involved in a real way in sustainable economic development in Haiti.
Okay, well, maybe one more here. This one.
Hi, my name is Fran. I have a question about capacity building. We talked a lot about working alongside NGOs, but I was wondering what efforts are being made to work with the Haitian government in order for them to take up some of these projects when the U.S. government, the U.N., and international NGOs eventually leave.
Okay, questions on capacity building the Haitian government, long-term economic policies, and birth certificates.
Would you like to jump in? Yes.
Birth certificate on working with the government quickly. On birth certificate, couple of NGOs that minor project about making people aware about ways to get access to ID cards or birth registration, but it was mainly awareness building. A couple of U.S. NGOs were involved in that. Those projects have come to an end now. We have also one project in Léogan with an Haitian NGO where we are providing birth certificates to kids who either displaced or who never got birth certificates for the reasons that you stated, getting access to education at least, but also avoiding the risk that those people become stateless, which is a real possibility under Haitian legislation. So we'd like to embark on a more ambitious project next year with the with UNICEF and with the Ministry of Justice that is competent in this matter. For that, we need a Ministry of Justice that is willing to cooperate. We'd like to set up a mobile documentation team like we did in Colombia or in some other places, in Guatemala a couple of years ago. That could work. But behind that, there is the whole civil registration that needs to be fixed, that needs to be digitalized. You talked about fingerprinting. There's so much work to be done. A Canadian cooperation had started some project in 2005, building a big database with the Organization of American States. It was a huge multi-million dollar project. All database collapsed during the earthquake. There was no backup, so it's starting from scratch. Now, that brings me to working. So we will start something subject to availability of funding. We will start something in January, but we're still not sure at this stage whether what sort of money we will have for birth registration. And we will start probably outside of Port-au-Prince. It's more easy to start there and build some good practice. And it's more easy to work with local tribunals in the province than in Port-au-Prince for the time being. Working with government, yes, we have to start somewhere. We should not postpone the engagement with the authorities. But, I mean, to be frank, and I'm not politically correct here, is that it's difficult, you know. Most of the people you talk to in the government, they don't get their salary paid. They don't know whether they're going to be there in January. So the level of engagement, of commitment is not just there. Sense of priority, I don't get it from many of the government interlocutors I talk to. Let's hope that, you know, when we have a new government, at least we can focus on some project. And there we will work with them. But it's going to take time. It's going to take time.
Holly or Sarah?
Just to add to what Vincent was just saying, a lot of times when we talk about working with the Haitian government, really what we're talking about is working with President Preval and Prime Minister Bellefeuve. I think one important thing that we need to think about going forward is really the idea of a broad civil service reform. Working with the Haitian government should not mean working with, you know, two interlocutors. It should mean working with various folks all throughout the government.
Was it ever different before the earthquake? Was it ever different?
Was whatever? Sorry.
The political system.
America working, the Haitian government functioning, and it seems to me it was that way before.
Right, and that's what I'm saying, is that
why wasn't this done before? Why wasn't this done before? How does the United Nations feel they're doing? Do they upgrade themselves periodically?
Let me just finish my one thought, and then we can get to that. In terms of the civil service reform, what we're thinking, or what we've been sort of talking about, is trying to get a better understanding of, and I don't think the U.S. government is the best place to do this, so I'll just put that right out there. But let's think about broad civil service reform in terms of hiring standards, in terms of testing, in terms of making sure that salaries are paid and on time, because government will change over. And every time the government changes over, which we've seen time and time and time again, you cannot lose all of your institutional knowledge when the civil service sort of goes out with the top level. So that's just one way that we're thinking about engaging. And then I can't speak for the United Nations.
Maybe we'll give you a chance first, and then if you'd like to answer the question about how the UN evaluates itself. Or maybe you should talk after the session. Yes, please, Sarah.
I can just give a few examples of engagement with local authorities and national actors that kind of might just give you an interesting take on things. I know Holly spoke a lot about the Haitian National Police, and one thing that the international community has tried to do is to engage the police more actively in patrolling camps and the sites of displaced people. And in some of the camps where we've worked, I've engaged specifically with female officers of the HNP and spoken with them about, you know, their special role in being a role model for women and girls and, you know, offering assistance. And they just laughed and they said, you know, we're in no better shape than these girls here in this camp. We're in a terrible situation in our lives, in our homes, and, you know, we're not role models and we don't have anything special to offer. And I said, well, you know, you have a job and you're dressed in uniform and you're fit and you look healthy and people are looking to you, you know, to fulfill a special role here. And so I think that there is a bit of a demoralization in the ranks of the civil service that makes it more difficult for them to do their job. But we have had success in terms of engaging with local mayors and at the municipal level asking the authorities to make additional land or space available for temporary shelters so that we can decongest certain areas where we're working, where people are overly concentrated, where even spatial differentiation will improve the protection environment. So I'd say that sometimes the goal of engaging the national authorities is too much at that top level, and you have to look for opportunities where they exist, and they could be at a much more localized level, and people should be taking advantage of any opportunity they can.
Okay, listen, I want to thank you all. I know that there are a few more questions, but perhaps you could come up after the session. But thank you all for coming, and apologies we weren't more upbeat. It has to do with the nature of the situation in Haiti, and I think the experiences. I think there's a lot of anger.
There really should be.
I think there's a lot of anger.
Correct. We have known this in Haiti for many, many years. I've worked there totally unsuccessfully for 40 years. Total disaster, worst part of my career because I've been unsuccessful. We've known this. This is not new. We've done nothing. We should take responsibility. I do.
Thank you all very much, and see you next time.